All right, good morning. My name is Jacob. I'm one of the pastors here. Before we jump in, I want to give a pitch. We are going into the summer months starting next week. During the summer in our children's ministry, we actually give our volunteers the opportunity to take the summer off, which means that our children's ministry is going to be short on volunteers. We would love, if you're able or interested, to pick a Sunday to sign up to serve in our children's ministry. You can sign up on the way out. They don't bite. Some of them probably do bite, but we are working on that, and it's not too bad. We'd love if you want to jump in. I'm excited to get to share with you today as we continue in our series that we're calling Built Together, where we study through the book of Ephesians. Today, I get the privilege of teaching one of the most fun sections of the entire book as we close out the fourth chapter. Today, we'll primarily be focusing on chapter 4, verses 14 through 24, and I'd like to open by reading these passages. If you have a Bible, you can follow along. If not, it'll be up on the screen. Ephesians 4, 14 through 24. Then, we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching, and by the cunning and craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. From him, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. So I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they are full of greed. That, however, is not the way of life you learned when you heard about Christ and were taught in him accordance to the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught, with regard to your former way of life, to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your mind, and to put on the new self created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. I can't even tell you how excited I am for this. These sets of passages encapsulate everything I do here at the church, and I'm so passionate about it. I hope you are too. This is so much fun. If you were here last week, my good friend Zach made a few disparaging comments about Hallmark movies, which is sad for him, because he's wrong, and Hallmark is awesome. And I wanted to start there just a little, although not just Hallmark, but one of my big passions, one of my big hobbies, which is the nature of storytelling, the story structure and the way story draws you in, but also what it looks like when a story is just slightly off. Now, last week, our lead pastor, Zach, said that one of the things he struggles with in Hallmark movies is that they're so formulaic. He said they're all pretty much the same. Can you believe that? I mean, he's right. 100% he's correct. You can usually guess almost every major plot point for a Hallmark movie by the 14-minute mark or so. What's interesting for me, however, is that romance novels follow similar formulaic plots. However, even with that level of formula, romance novel sales are through the roof. On Amazon, romance novels account for roughly 50% of all book sales, especially with the invention of the Kindle. Because now you can read your romance novel about the long-haired Fabio on the cover, which is something of an old reference, without anyone seeing the cover and embarrassing you. That is him if you don't know who Fabio is. Which, by the way, it was really difficult to find a picture of him with his shirt on, which I thought was necessary for Sunday morning. I did eventually find it. Now the question is it just Hallmark or romance movies that are formulaic? Or is it possible that Star Wars, any comedy, any Disney or Pixar, or even your favorite movies like Lord of the Rings are just as formulaic, and prepare yourself for what I'm about to say, do they even follow the exact same formula as Hallmark? If that thought makes you uncomfortable, here we go. If you're a fan of film theory or did a film studies class in college, you may have heard of a man named Blake Snyder. Back in 2004, Blake Snyder wrote a book called Save the Cat, where he took a look at many of the popular movies over the last few decades and broke them down into a set of 15 specific beats or formulas that people followed. He didn't create the formula, he merely codified it after seeing it play out over and over again in movies. Really, Blake Snyder was just putting fresh paint on something we've often referred to as the monomyth, or the hero's journey. In his book, he showed that all of those movies that most people love, the romantic comedies, the action movies, the dramas, the Disney and children movies, the romance movies, heck, pretty much every mainstream movie that's released in the last 20 years all followed the same structure, even going so far as to hit some of the same plot points and beats on the same pages of the script. I mean, here's the general structure of an action or sci-fi movie. You know how the young action hero is usually doing something dangerous. They're called somewhere and they find their true calling. They usually save someone or something. Maybe it's a droid, maybe it's a hobbit, maybe it's a cat in a tree. They befriend a group of lovable misfits. They go off to save the day with the lovable misfits. They experience hardships and setbacks, normally by finding out that one of the villains is one of their dads. They overcome their trials. They find the strength within to save the day. And in the end, they settle into a new life, which has a lot of parallels to how their life started at the beginning. Now, to go completely different, here's the general structure of a Hallmark movie. You know how the young hero or heroine is working a tough job. They get called somewhere else and they find their calling, probably managing a duck farm or something like that. They usually save someone or something, probably the dog of a single dad with a cute kid, or save a friend from an embarrassing faux pas by taking the blame. They befriend a group of lovable misfits, usually a coffee shop owner or the aforementioned single dad with the dog. They go off to live life to the fullest with this group of lovable misfits. They experience hardships and setbacks, normally by finding out that their dad wants them to make money and not just run a duck farm. They overcome their trials, they find the strength to win, and they save the day. And then the ending scene has a lot of parallels to how their life started at the beginning of the movie. Hey, what do you know? They're not that different. Nearly every Marvel movie, every Disney movie, every Pixar movie, Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, every Hallmark movie, almost without exception, follows this formula, the hero's journey, or the monomyth. And we'll get into this later, but Blake Snyder talks about how sometimes movies miss an important step, and it ends up feeling disjointed or uncomfortable. It's that feeling when you leave a movie, and you think, there's something off. There's something that isn't sitting quite right, and I actually can't name it. Now, it's not that it was bad, but I just feel like it missed slightly. We'll talk more about that later. And this brings us back to Save the Cat. The book's title is chosen because Blake Snyder talked about how important it was for the hero of your story to do something heroic early on so that people knew who they were. And it wasn't enough to tell it. You can't just say that someone is the sheriff, or they are a superhero, or they are a good person. It might be true, but it doesn't draw people in. No, instead you have the hero save a cat from a tree, or stop a group of bandits, or stop to help a fellow employee who dropped their folder full of papers in the lobby, or save the dog of that single dad. It fits all genres. We want to know who the hero or heroine is because they do heroic things. We want to know them by their actions and not just by what we're told about them. And this actually leads us straight into Ephesians that we're going to talk about today. Because Paul actually says the same things in regard to faith. He says you can tell people what you want. You can tell them what you believe, all the while expressing what it means to be a follower of Christ. But what does it mean to show your faith? What does it mean to show and not just tell? What does it mean to stop talking about saving the cat and actually save one? And in fact, I'm going to propose a set of questions for you to chew on as we go through this section. If you're here today and you would call yourself a follower of Christ, what is the mark of being a Christian? What does it look like? And is it something that people will only really know because you tell them what you believe? Or is it something that can be seen? If you're a follower of Christ, and you look back at the day you first came to know who Jesus was, and you follow the trajectory of that decision until today, is there anything different about you? What has God done in you and through you? And if you're here today and you are not a follower of Christ, you're just trying to figure things out, what would you say is something that should set Christians apart? How can you know them by their actions? Here we go. Ephesians 4 is generally considered a turning point in the book of Ephesians. To incredibly oversimplify it, Ephesians 1 through 3 reflects this theological premise set by Paul. The Jews and the Gentiles are now one church due to the redemptive power of Jesus Christ, and thank God for that redemption. Ephesians 1 through 3 is intentionally highly theological in nature. And now in Ephesians 4, for the first time, we have Paul beginning to make the turn. He's moving from the foundational premises he's set, and he's moving us to the practical side, a section sometimes referred to as Christian ethics. In other words, you are set apart. You are redeemed. You are chosen. You are loved. God fought the good fight on behalf of you. This is everything Zach talked about last week. So now what? What do you do with that? You've been saved. God wants a relationship with you. That part is done. So now what? What does growth look like? How do you practically follow God? What are your actions? How do you reflect that? To start, let's take a look at the foundational set of verses that's going to tell us what Paul's thinking. If you have a Bible, we're going to look back at Ephesians 4, 14 through 17. Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching and by the cunning and craftiness of people and their deceitful scheming. Instead, speaking the truth in love, we will grow to become in every respect the mature body of him who is the head, that is Christ. From him, the whole body, joined and held together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. So I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. There's a lot of fun stuff in there we're going to talk about. A few things to keep in mind as we move forward. This terminology of infants and mature bodies. This concept of ligaments and support and growth. And then this statement from Paul, I insist on it in the Lord. You must no longer live the way you did. First, let's talk about Paul's usage of the word infants and mature body. Last September, we did a teaching on the levels of spiritual growth and how you walk in faith. There's some similarity here, and if we're not careful, there can be a few mental blocks that come up from using words like infant and mature. First, you're going to notice that Paul is using a lot of growth, muscle, and body language here. So this usage is actually going to make a lot of sense as we move forward, but if we're not careful, it can confuse what we're trying to get across. Infant or newborn baby is not a mark of age in this situation. It's also not a mark of disrespect or denigration. If you consider your spiritual growth in the same sense you consider your physical growth, it means just that. If you begin following Christ at 60 years old, you would be a 60-year-old spiritual infant. You're new to faith. You're new to figuring it out. You're learning the ropes of what Christ calls you to, and that's so good. There's nothing bad about it. It's so amazing to be starting your spiritual growth journey at no matter what age you are, because it's such a gift of freedom. And that journey of growth isn't always linear, and it's not time-gated. And we develop at different speeds in different ways in different areas. And sometimes everyone around you is running and going in different directions. And sometimes you just pause and you breathe. And you marinate in what God is showing you. You rest and you listen. And that intentional pause while others are running around can be just as fulfilling or growing, even if it looks like standing still. So as we talk about stages of spiritual growth and discipleship and spiritual maturity and topics like that, you don't have to have any shame for where you are. There's no shame in how long it takes you to get to where you're going. Just like we don't shame kids who take longer to develop in certain areas, we don't shame people who are learning and growing at different speeds or in different ways. Now, just like Paul's use of the word infant and mature are based on spiritual growth and maturity, it's important to recognize a little bit the opposite. And that is that age and time with Jesus doesn't necessarily equal maturity. If you've been walking in faith for 30 years, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're a mature body, to use Paul's language. Spiritual maturity is a growth. Our spiritual maturity and growth is a process and requires us to make choices and sacrifices, usually daily. And for many of us, our growth can actually become stunted based on the choices we make. Some of us are sitting and waiting and marinating and learning, and some of us are just stuck. And interestingly, I think it's fully possible to sit in church every single Sunday, attend every event you can, jump into a small group, and still struggle to mature and grow in your faith. In fact, I know this to be true because the writer of the book of Hebrews saw this with a group of believers they were teaching. If you have a Bible, it's Hebrews 5:12. In fact, Though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you the elementary truth of God's words all over again. You need milk, not solid food. The writer of Hebrews saw a group of people who should have been so far along in their faith and understanding of God, but for whatever reason, they weren't growing up. They were stunted, they were slowed down, or they had just stopped. Interesting as well, he doesn't say, you didn't listen to me, or I had to chase you, or you didn't show up. No, they say, by this time, you ought to be teachers. In other words, you've put in the time. You know the answers. What happened? To continue with the writer of Hebrews' food analogy, you can think of spiritual growth sort of like making soup. Now, you can make a soup and serve it quickly, and it's fine. Or you can layer the flavors. You can nurture it. You can let it reduce a little bit. You can let it absorb all of the things you put in. Good soup is usually better the next day because those flavors have time to seep in. It's a soup made with intention. At the same time, you can let a soup sit on the stovetop for so long that it over-reduces, grows almost inedibly salty, and would take a lot of work to fix, and sometimes you just have to start over. This is what the writer of Hebrews is talking about. Sometimes we sit for so long that we just get stuck. Which brings us to our primary question of the day, and I think the primary question of Ephesians 4, and it's a nebulous one. Where are you in your walk with God? If spiritual maturity is a spectrum from infant to fully mature, where are you at? And maybe even better, how do you know? I can give you a few mile markers to check in on, but this may look different for different people. Last September, we did a series on spiritual growth and maturity, and if you're wondering, I'd encourage you to check out that series. If you go back and watch this online, I'll make sure to link those sermons in the description for you to check out. We have this thing called just a spiritual journey. And back in September, we introduced these mile markers of the Christian journey. You may recall them if you were around. One of the books that it talks about this is called The Critical Journey, and it's a wonderful read. Now, as you see these mile markers, I want to give a couple of words of caution. First, the fact that they're numbered presents an issue. It can feel like the goal is to race to get as high up as possible, or feel shame when you realize you're not as far along as you think you should be. It's not necessarily true. You don't actually graduate from these stages and never go back. This is a little bit fluid. As you progress, you're traveling back and forth as you continue to learn more about yourself and God. And second, this can feel far too formulaic for some. No problem. Use this as a tool or not, but sometimes if you're stuck, that self-diagnostic can be helpful. So here's what I want to do. I want to share just a tiny bit about each of these stages, and if anything stands out to you, and if you hear something, you're like, oh my gosh, that's me, hold on to it, because it's going to give you some ideas for what some next steps are for you. The first one is called recognition of God. This is that first moment. This is the time where you have the opportunity to first encounter who Jesus is and hear what he has for you. This is the opportunity to start a faith journey, the finding and encountering God. And if this is where you are, the place that you move from this is the movement into community, that movement into following teaching. We're going to hear a lot from Paul about community. The second stage is called the life of discipleship. This is done in community. This is learning. This is absorbing. This is coming into a small group. This is sitting in service. This is hearing the message. This is taking it all in. This is jumping into events. This is learning. Moving through this is recognizing your uniqueness, your gifting, your contribution. It isn't enough just to absorb. You have something to bring. And in fact, Paul, here in just a second, is going to tell us that if you're not using your uniqueness for the body of Christ, we are all losing. It's not just you losing, we are losing because your gifts, your uniqueness, were put there by God for everybody. Most churches are really good at stage two and three, and stage one, because we can measure them, because we can see how many people are here on a Sunday morning, who's in small groups, who's serving. We can figure out baptisms. Those are easier to measure. These next ones are not. Stage four is called the journey inward. This often looks like the stage of questioning and doubt, the stage where you start to wonder, the stage where you start to look at some of your foundations and realize there's some holes there. There's some questions I'm afraid to ask. In fact, there's some questions that I might ask that could just tumble the whole thing down. Depending on your church tradition, everything I just said is taboo. That's not something you do. What I've learned is there are a lot of people in this church who have questions that you're afraid to ask. That's really normal. Moving through this is so difficult. It's the movement from being self-centered and certain to letting God out of the box. Who is God and what does he want from us? And what does the mystery of God actually mean? And am I okay not being certain about things because God is mysterious? That scares the heck out of me. That's so, so tough. It's the movement from ego to God's will. There's this sub-piece they talk about called the wall. That's this place of discomfort and intellectualism and self. And the pursuit of healing and spiritual truth, it can be uncomfortable and feel like you're falling apart. It can feel like those foundational pieces aren't fitting the way they used to. And the movement through this looks like surrender and healing and closeness to God and discernment. Some of these stages can feel like they take little time at all, and some can feel like they take a long, long time. I think stage four is often a long, long time. Stage five, the journey outward, is this understanding that faith means surrendering to God. This place of calm and stillness and concern for others, a place coming out of healing and recognizing God's movement all around us. Moving through this is all about being God's person, recognizing your place in God's story and being willing to use your strengths and weaknesses and all you are, because that's all God called you to do. It's a place of surrender and openness. And finally, the last one that one of our elders once listed as pretty darn Christ-like, it's living in total obedience to God. All of these are kind of just mile markers. They're stages people go through. Those last two in particular, you've probably met some people like that. They're the people that you spend time with and you go, why are you so different? Like, what do you have that I just need? Like, there's something there that I might be missing. There's a peace, there's a calmness, there's a, for lack of a better term, a holy moment sometimes with these people. Some of these I imagine you hear and you think, yeah, that could be me. Others I can imagine you hear and think, oh my gosh, are there actually people who live that way? And for many of us, we hear this and think, I'm a bit like four of these. And that's okay. This is just a starting point and a method for us to self-evaluate and start thinking through what we need. It can be so easy to get stuck in our faith, and sometimes all we need to do is a self-diagnostic so we even have an idea what to do. Again, these stages are fluid. You can move back and forth through them intentionally and never actually graduate a stage. But all of this stage movement usually requires others as well. It isn't something we do alone. In fact, Paul highly encourages people with the language of Ephesians 4 that it didn't work as well just to do it by yourself. We can find it by looking back for a third time at Ephesians 4:17. From him, the whole body, joined together by every supporting ligament, grows and builds itself up in love as each part does its work. So I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord. You must no longer live as the Gentiles do, the futility of their thinking. This idea of the whole body is a reference to the body of believers, that all of us are necessary for helping the whole body, this group, grow. I love this idea of ligaments or tendons or joints, whatever the translation is. Paul wanted us to know that the spiritual growth in the body of Christ is about more than just what we easily see. Paul wanted us to make sure that we know that spiritual growth and maturity is not done solo. We weren't designed that way. If you were to take a church and ask what they are about, people may mention the pastors, the elders, the announcement person who makes them laugh. They may mention the events. They may mention the belief. They may mention the feel. They may talk about their programs or their Christmas service. They may talk about what you'd refer to as the muscles, the things that look showy and that everyone knows because they're easy to see. But if you're not careful, you miss the ligaments. One of Colorado's Pro Bowl football players was a man named Terrell Davis. We'll throw a picture up here, mostly so you can see how massive his legs are. Terrell Davis was a monster. Over seven seasons, he played in the 97-98 Super Bowl winning teams, and he was a powerhouse on the field. In fact, here's a quick picture of his stat line from ESPN.com. Over 7 seasons, and in just 78 games, he put up almost 9,000 yards between receiving and rushing. He was nominated for 3 Pro Bowls and was inducted into the 2017 Hall of Fame. However, if you read that stat line, you may notice something interesting. Most of those 9,000 yards were accomplished in just 4 of his 7 years. Because right here, after year 4, Terrell Davis tore his ACL. You know that small band of connective tissue in your knee? Despite his prowess, despite his huge muscles, his game sense, his ridiculous stats, and his God-given talent, that ACL tear started the end of an illustrious career. While not always meaning the end of a career, when pro athletes experience ACL injuries, it tends to be a huge impediment. The comeback is brutal. The body being unable to do what it could before is tough, and that slight twinge of fear every time you make a cut or turn that you might hurt yourself again is maddening. You take these huge pro athletes who have quads bigger than your head, and this tiny little ligament has a bigger effect on them than any amount of muscle. Because while the muscles we see can look impressive and do a lot of heavy lifting, without the ligaments and the tendons and connective pieces, those muscles are at best operating under diminished capacity and at worst become almost unusable. You know one of the ways you grow spiritually? You do it with others. Because we were never designed to go it alone. That's why we're always pushing community and events and small groups and parties and discipleship. Because when you look at the stages of spiritual growth, when you look at spiritual growth on a spectrum from infant to mature adult, people rarely go it alone. You usually need someone to help push you or ask the right questions or just be someone you can bounce things off of. Because in some seasons of life, you may be a muscle, but without the ligaments to support you, you're at diminished capacity. And in some seasons, you may be the ligament that someone else needs to pivot and move. All right, at this point, we've given some mile markers. We've given some ideas on the spectrum of spiritual growth, and I think we've impressed on this the need to do this with others. Now, as we look at the close of Ephesians 4, we're going to go back to some of our ideas about story structure. What is the story of your life, and what are you showing? Paul is going to give us some practical advice for what spiritual growth looks like and what it looks like to take off the old self and put on the new. Paul begins at the end of Ephesians 4 with some contrasting language when he talks about the journey to spiritual maturity. And it'd be easy to take the end of Ephesians 4 as an exhaustive list about how we should conduct ourselves, but I don't think that's what Paul is trying to get across. I think he wants to give some really concrete examples we should follow, but also extrapolate from. Think of the end of Ephesians 4 as a template you can filter most of your life through. He uses a lot of language centered around the concept of the old versus the new self. In other words, Christ paid the price. He won the victory. He conquered death and he set you free. Now, what does living in the freedom he created you for look like? Be obedient to the God who set you apart and live in that freedom. Here are some concrete examples. It's a summary of the end of Ephesians 4. Put off falsehood and speak truthfully, because we're all one body. Don't let the sun go down while you're angry. Don't steal, but work with your hands so that you can share with those in need. Don't let unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but instead build others up and let that benefit anyone who listens. Do not drive out the Holy Spirit. Bring God into your life and your problems and your solutions, because God redeemed you. Get rid of bitterness and rage and anger, brawling and slander and any form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another and forgive as Christ forgave you. And finally, Ephesians 5, 1 and 2, follow God's example. Therefore, as dearly loved children, and walk in the way of love, just as Christ loves us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. You noticed it, right? The old versus new self, the contrasting language, the movement language, the action language. I'm going to refer to this in storytelling as show, don't tell. In storytelling, there are generally considered 2 ways to introduce something. You can show it, or you can tell it. One involves letting the audience know what's happening. The other involves dropping them in the action. I'll give you an example I made up using Superman, because Superman's awesome. Telling goes like this. There was a high-pitched ringing sound traveling through the air as the alarm from Metropolis Savings and Loan began to echo. Bank robbers had just taken over the largest bank in Metropolis, but not before the alarm was pushed. Luckily for the customers inside, Superman was already flying toward the bank to save the day. In a flash, he flew through the side of the building, apprehended the bank robbers, and the day was saved. Tells us exactly what's happening and leaves little to the imagination. Showing goes like this. Gerald rubbed his hand across the rough stubble on his chin. Hearing a squeak behind him, he brandished his weapon at the offending noise. The bank teller, who'd been thinking about making a break for it, shrunk down and tried to make herself seem smaller, but not before subtly tapping the small red button under her desk. Gerald stared at her for a minute before turning away. He wasn't here seeking anything but the money, but he was committed to doing anything he needed to see the job through. Suddenly, out of the corner of his vision, he saw a flash of red and blue. By the time he turned his head, one of his fellow bank robbers had disappeared, seemingly without a trace. Gerald shook his head as his plan came crashing down around him. He let out a long sigh as the caped man, dressed in his telltale red and blue suit and brandishing a stylized S on his chest, floated from the ceiling and landed gently on the floor in front of him. Less than 2 minutes for you to arrive. What a joke. How's a criminal supposed to make any money around here? Gerald asked as he laid his weapon on the ground and raised his hands. They both tell a similar story. There's a bank robbery, Superman comes and saves the day, but they're also night and day different. One of them tells the story and the other one shows you it and brings you in. Blake Snyder talks about movies that you watch and don't quite sit right with you. You walk out of the theater, you turn off the TV, and you sit there and think, I didn't love it and I don't know why. It's usually because of things like overtelling and not showing or missing beats and structure. Because something can be close but still completely miss the mark. And that's what Paul wanted us to know. There's an old self, and it's the things we fall back on a lot. It's our sinful nature. It's who we are without Christ. It's a habit. It's a place of comfort. Paul calls us to take it off, to physically move from that nature and into a new nature, the Christ who died for us. He won. We just have to move into it. And this can be so much easier said than done, but as we talk about growth and maturity, this is one of the pathways. And as a follower of Christ, if you're in here today, you are marked by God, and that mark should be able to be seen. People should look at you and wonder why you're different. People should hear you speak and wonder why there's no slander, no malice, and that you lift others up. People should look at you and wonder why you walk so much in love for others, while you and I know that you do it because Christ did the same thing for you, because you're God's mark and you're what he shows to the world. And you won't always get it right. Heck, you may not often get it right. But the difference is intentionality and effort. It's the difference between growing in your relationship with God, sometimes even needing him to carry you, and being content to sit in spiritual infancy. It's the choice between telling others who you are and what you believe and living in such a way that they can't help but see who you're showing them. That's Ephesians 4. I'm so excited for you to join us next week for Ephesians 5. I'd love if you would pray with us. Hey, God, it's Jake. God, I want to start by thanking you for the people in my life who I have just walked in maturity that paved the path for me. Now, the people that I can look to and think, man, I want to learn from them. I want to be like that. God, I pray for everyone in this room, Lord. I pray for everyone watching us online, God. I just pray as we look at where we are, God, that it would be the desire of our heart to just be a mark for you. And that it'd be the desire of our heart for people to see us and think, what is different about them? For us just to be a reflection of the God who saved us and loves us. God, thank you so much for letting us be here. Thanks for a beautiful day. Thanks for these people. Amen.